So I went out and I found some boards and I started asking questions because I got dreadfully stuck. I had no idea what I was doing. And people reached out to help me. The first person said, hey, that's really hard. Let's get on a call. And they helped me for an hour. And I thought, well, that's a little odd. Thank you. I don't know you. And then, a week later, somebody else did the same thing. And so what I was encountering was, I didn't even know, like, this was so strange. But the second person said to me, and I remember this now, but it didn't stick at the time. That person said, that's what we do here. And I thought, here? What are you talking about, right? I've been in technology for a really long time. There is no here.
That is Corey Snow, Senior Director for Higher Education over at Salesforce.org. I'm Josh Burke, Developer Evangelist for Salesforce. And here on the Salesforce Developer Podcast, you'll hear stories and insights from developers for developers. Today, we sit down and talk with Corey on a wide variety of topics, including his work with the community, his unique experience with Stagecraft. But let's start with his career at Salesforce.org.
Yeah, so I've been close to Salesforce.org since it was the foundation, and maybe there were 35 employees, and
right.
I knew most of them. That was a different time since I was in nonprofit before mm-hmm. I was in higher ed. And, Salesforce.org has grown up over time. There are just so many more nonprofit education institutions on the platform that now it's a pretty sizable business unit and become very professional. In fact, we're producing actual, custom products for the education market, custom products for the nonprofit market. And these are not things that existed when I first started working with Salesforce.org. They were really too small to be doing a lot of those investments. So honestly, the community built a lot of things, partly because Salesforce.org didn't have the internal capacity to do it back in the pioneer days. So yeah. Things like NPSP, which is the most installed app on the AppExchange, something that most folks don't know, that was actually built by the community.
Yeah.
And we know who the people were, and they're amazing, and they're all sort of my mentors and folks who I've known for some time. So, I think that early community, a lot of them were actually hired by Salesforce.org. So mm-hmm. by the time I moved to Salesforce.org, it felt like I was just going off to work with all of my close friends. So.
Gotcha. Nice. Can you describe some of those custom products that you're talking about for higher education?
Yeah, so we're very excited to have Salesforce Advisor Link is really the first kind of package product that Salesforce.org built for the education market. And this is really very much tailored to the idea of academic advising.
Yeah.
And, it's really great to have been able to build something that's specific for education, where, in the past, it was largely about repurposing things that were built for other industries. So that was a really good start. And recently we've announced, and we're, busily working away on a package for recruiting and admissions, which I think will be just really game changing for our industry. Everybody knows, right? Salesforce is an intake machine. I mean, it's really built mm-hmm. to do that
right.
Out of the box. And so we're really taking the power of the platform and typing it specifically for intake for higher education. And I think that's pretty helpful. I think I say higher education. I have to remember that we're serving the K-12 market now too.
Okay.
And I think that a lot of even nonprofit nonprofits who have educational missions might also benefit from our recruiting admissions package. I say that having worked at a nonprofit that was also an educational institution.
Got it. And how do higher ed summits play into the production of these products?
Oh, higher ed summit. So that was my favorite technology event of the year for these many years. It always felt like sort of our higher ed Super Bowl. And, it started before I was involved in higher ed, but grew so much mm-hmm. to the point where I think, had we had the in-person event in Indianapolis this year, we were looking at maybe 3,000 participants, which
wow.
is, triple what it was the first one I went to. And, I think by making it virtual, there are some, certainly some things that are lost in a virtual event, and we're all experiencing that in the COVID era. But there are some things that are gained. So, we have already got more registrants than 3,000 because, nice. The ability to participate is just is so much greater.
Right.
And I think we're seeing this, with Salesforce events of all kinds, that, the ability to participate enables more people to be part of the whole thing. So one of the things that we did virtually for the first time ever was something we hold called the Open Source Sprint. And I think you had Jason Lance on your show recently. He's a big proponent of open source software.
Yeah.
And we actually held, on pretty short notice, and, props to Judy Sohn and her team for, as the organizers, for being able to turn this around in only a few weeks. But, we virtualized that event and had typical participation, had it even been in person. But we had folks from India. We had folks from, all over the globe. And one of my favorite things was that if we were working on something, and we come along, we say, well, who knows a lot about that? Let's just call them up, right? So we'd have folks coming in to participate in the sprint for, 30 minutes just to bring their one little bit of expertise to the table.
Right.
That's pretty empowering. So, there is some gains in our virtualized world. I've been able to attend community group meetings from all around the globe. I did a couple weeks where I tried to hit, all six continents, because I don't think we have any Salesforce community groups in Antarctica yet. But I was doing pretty well. And it was just so interesting to, I was meeting people I never would have otherwise met. And so there are definitely some, advantages of the COVID era.
So, yeah, that's interesting. Jason definitely brought up the idea that even when they go physical again, that there probably will be some kind of a virtual counterpart in order to kind of keep some of that going. So out of curiosity, what was the format of the Higher Ed Summit in the physical realm, and how do you see that moving into the virtual?
Well, I'm excited. I don't know if this is safe harbor or not, but I'm excited to have gotten a little bit of a preview on the experience today. And I think people will be pleasantly surprised at how quickly some of the vendors who support events have already improved that kind of event experience into the COVID era. I was very impressed. I thought that, someday, because of the COVID era, people will invent better event experiences. They're already on it.
And, right.
They've got some kind of, corollaries of the in-person experience, like lobbies and breakout rooms and what's on the main stage. So just very impressed by what's happening. And, I think people who attend Higher Ed Summit will be, surprised how much of the experience can transcend space and time.
Nice. Okay, so let's step back in time a little bit, because I think this was in your earlier days maybe your MVP or pre-MVP days, but you had a very specific goal when it came to public speaking. What was that?
I did. So in 2016, I started doing more presentations. I'd just done a few, maybe six, including a speaking engagement at Dreamforce. And a lot of folks were telling me that they were getting a lot out of these presentations, which I didn't really expect, because I'm not something I had much practice at. So I didn't think I'd be much good at it.
Yeah.
But worse, I have this thing called glossophobia, which is a fear of public speaking. And it turns out that, I did a little research into it at the time, because I thought it's so strange that I have so much anxiety around being on stage. Well, it turns out that 74% of people have glossophobia.
Oh, wow.
And public speaking is rated number one on people's top fear list above death itself and many things that actually would kill you.
Right.
And I thought, this is really strange. So I asked around, dug into it a little more. And this is a primal thing, because, public speaking, or just standing out in your tribe, right, is an opportunity to say something wrong or do something wrong, which in primal times may have caused you to be cast out of the tribe, which was, you know, essentially a death sentence.
Right.
In a kind of Stone Age era, right? So right. I think we carry this forward in our lizard brains as a really big fear.
Yeah.
And the other thing I learned just from asking the folks who were doing presentations who I admired most, turns out most of them also were fearful of public speaking. They had imposter syndrome. And I thought, well, wait a minute. If the presenters I admire most, who I'm getting kind of the most value from, are also afraid of public speaking, there must be something to it. So
right.
I don't usually set New Year's resolutions, but in New Year's of 2017, I made two. One of them was that I would be on 26 stages in 2017. And the other was that I would figure out this Twitter thing, which just kind of didn't make any sense to me, but I felt right. like I was missing out on a conversation. And right. actually, those two things really changed the kind of arc of my career in unexpected ways. You know, the Twitter thing has become my, you know, sort of this crazy trusted learning network
yeah.
and opened all kinds of opportunities. I've met so many people. And then on the public speaking arc, you know, I met my goal. I exceeded the 26. I got, I believe, 32 for the year. I was on 32 stages wow. for the year. And I counted a stage as anything where I had a prepared, you know, presentation on stage in front of people.
Yeah.
Or a webinar, you know, kind of corollary of that. And so I started doing a lot of presentations. And then one of the things that happens when you do a lot of presentations is people ask you to do more presentations. And I didn't really know how to say no because I never had so many invites. And so in the first yeah. quarter of 2018, I was on 39 stages in one quarter, which is too many. Never do that. That's too many.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had to, you know, cut back on that.
Yeah.
But I think the thing I really learned is that it wasn't so much that I needed to be on stage. It was more that what I learned in this sort of empowerment journey is that there are a lot of people with really great stories who are afraid mm-hmm. to be on stage or don't know they could be on stage or nobody's asked them
right.
to be on stage. So I started doing that instead. So I used my community group platform as a means of organizing an event. So you know, a single, you know, an all-day event, I might have 10 presentations. That's 10 people on stage telling stories that otherwise would not have been told.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the big culmination of that was really Northeast Dreamin'. So, you know, we got Northeast Dreamin' going. That was 36 stages to fill. And mm-hmm. I was on the content group, you know, which is a really, really great team. And that's 36 stages with stories that would not have been told, and I'm on none of them. But we were really, you know, we were really careful about saying, look, you don't need any speaking experience and we will yeah. help you. And right down to, we'll work with you on developing, you know, your presentation from the idea you submitted all the way through to being on stage with you on the day to support you.
Yeah.
And this was all, you know, sort of from my base of being a fearful public speaker. I thought, if we're going to create the best speaking experience anyone's ever had, this is what, you know, I would have wanted when I was, you know, starting out on doing a lot of presentations.
Right.
So that's sort of the flip on it.
Well, okay. So a couple follow-up questions there. First of all, how did you come up with the number 26?
Well, I figured that I could do one every 2 weeks. So mm-hmm. it was as simple as that. And okay. then, you know, I also figured, you know, I don't have to really do one every 2 weeks. If I go to World Tour and I present three times, that's three in one day. Or if I go right. to Hired Summit and I present five times, that's five in 1 week. So, yeah, you know, they tended to be clustered around events.
Got
and
it.
Then I would sort of throw extra events around the events as well, you know, just to maximize
just to
the
multiply
community.
It out, right?
Yeah, just to multiply it out. More stories.
Okay, so if 26 is high enough and 39 is too high, what's about right?
Well, I think 39 in one quarter is too many.
Right.
39 in a year, you know, that might be a stretch. But, you right. know, I'll tell you, and, you know, you as someone who's worked for Salesforce for a long time, I think, you know, for example, 12 presentations at Dreamforce is too many. Never do that.
Yes, it's way too many. And let's see, Adam's episode will have come out by now. And we talked about this to a certain extent. And for an event like Dreamforce, which is like roughly a week long, you know, you want to enjoy the event. And if you're speaking even five times at Dreamforce, you're going to be distracted a lot and you might not going to enjoy the event so much. So, you know, speaking once or twice at Dreamforce is still a huge achievement, and just run with that.
Yeah, that's plenty. And it's really not, it should never be about quantity. So, right. You know, sometimes I regret that I set a quantity goal, but it was more just challenging that version of me to have a new version of me that could be more courageous in storytelling.
Yeah.
But not for me, for the value of sharing information with other people and enabling them, you know, to travel the journey that where other people had helped me. So it was really just paying it forward. I had so many people in the Salesforce ecosystem that had enabled my career, and I owed that back with interest. And so, you know, the two people who reached out to me in those first few weeks when I was just getting started, I had a goal that I would help at least two other people with calls, you know, so 2 hours of outreach and calls. I felt that that was what I owed back to the community. So that my goal was always to have at least 2 hours of outreach calls. And, you know, I would find people who were posting things wherever on the Trailblazer community or, you know, on a Slack channel or on Twitter, anywhere. And if they looked like, you know, I could help them, I would reach out and say, hey, how about a call? That I can probably help you through that. That was the way that I, you know, paid back with a little bit of interest what everyone else had given me over that time.
Gotcha. So let's talk about some of those tips. I want to talk about Stagecraft, but before you can get on stage, you have to have a session that's actually being accepted. So what are the challenges and lessons learned you've had through doing a submission process?
I do have a story around that. So for the first Higher Ed Summit, which was the first place that I thought I might do speaking in 2016, I submitted, I think, five sessions, and none of them were accepted, not even one.
Gotcha.
And so, you know, I tried to learn from that. So I actually looked at all the presentations that had been accepted, and I looked at presentations that hadn't been accepted. And I started to kind of learn, you know, what the algorithm was for, you know, presentations that had kind of that right balance of being relevant to, you know, to the audience, and, you know, being really meaningful and empowering. And, you know, part of it is sort of the wording, you know, trying to get, you know, a powerful message in 80 characters is actually a special challenge.
Right.
So, I think for the next one, I had 8 accepted, which was too many. I had to cut back on that. But more importantly, I learned from that process how to enable other people to do the CFP submission process. So I was able to get somewhere around, I think it was about 18 accepted presentations at the next Higher Ed Summit that I had helped shepherd people through.
Yeah.
Just largely by just from my experience and what I was seeing, and, you know, also what I was hearing in, you know, kind of the market, I guess, of ideas for where things were trending, and there wasn't enough, you know, there weren't enough stories around it.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that we had in higher education was once people learned how to spell CRM, they started saying, well, that's great, but maybe we want to communicate with those people, right?
Right.
So there was this secondary wave of interest in marketing tools and marketing automation. And when that wave hit, we didn't actually have a lot of really great storytellers for that. So,
gotcha.
You know, so I knew if I could find folks who were able to do presentations on Marketing Cloud, Pardot, marketing automation, I knew that those were in demand, and that, you know, emerging technologies like Einstein, you know, definitely in demand. So, you know, things that were emergent often have fewer experts to talk about them than they have consumers who are interested. So there's sort of this arbitrage gap in the idea market.
And what's your process for putting the deck together and practicing for the session?
So when I was an even more fearful public speaker,
right,
I would spend 50 hours probably preparing for a 40-minute session.
Gotcha.
I was so fearful. I would write out every word that I was going to say.
Yeah.
I would practice it using all those words. And one of the things I'd find is that even if I did all that, I would get on stage and I would forget my script, no matter right. how many times I practice it. Right.
Yeah.
So, and I think a lot of folks can relate to that. So I definitely had to cut back. And Mark Baisman, who I'm sure you know very well, and
yep.
Mark Baisman is probably the person who more than anybody introduced me to the power of the Salesforce community, because
yeah.
he was the nonprofit leader in Boston before he wound up working for Salesforce.org and then Salesforce.com as well.
Yeah.
He would talk about, and he has a really great presentation he does on being an improviser.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, if you have 5 presentations in one day, you're going to have to improvise. You can't
right.
spend 50 hours preparing for all of the, all those presentations. So I think it's much more important to put out what you're hoping to convey and thinking about the messages that you want to convey and worry less about the specific words. And I was always surprised that the words would come to me, even
yeah.
if I had it written them down.
Right.
And this is still for me a giant leap of faith.
Right.
I'm talking to your audience now. I have no script. So
right.
I'm just making this up as I go along. And I'm hopeful that when you ask me a question, that the idea is there and the words will follow. And
yeah.
sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But that's just the reality. If you want to be out there, if you want to be sharing ideas, if you want to be helping other people, you're going to have to take some risks.
Right.
And this is, one of those risks is that the ideas don't come or the wrong words come. The wrong words come at the wrong time, or the right words don't come at the right time, or whatever it may be.
Right.
It can be challenging. So, being on stage is a risk right away. And I haven't found that hyper preparing helps me in any special way. Before my very first presentation at Dreamforce,
mm-hmm.
which I'd spent a lot of time preparing for, I actually by accident ran into a session at Dreamforce on the first day. Just because the door was open, I didn't even read the sign. I just thought, well, this is starting now.
Right.
I'm standing here. I've got an hour to kill.
Yeah.
I'm just going to wander in and see what they have to say.
Yeah.
Well, it turned out that it was being put on by the folks who make all the keynotes for
yeah.
the Salesforce executives. And it was mm-hmm. about how to put on a killer presentation.
Yeah.
And I went home, threw the whole thing away, and started again. Fortunately, my presentation was on day 3, but I threw the whole thing out.
Yeah.
And then I went back to I was staying with family, and I practiced in front of my 10-year-old niece. If you
yeah.
want a tough audience who's going to tell you what's what, practice in front of a 10-year-old
girl,
because they're going to tell you what's what.
Right.
And they're going to give you no slack. They are unfiltered. There's no one more courageous than a 10-year-old girl.
That is perfect. Nice. And I just have to echo some of those points, because I've coached a lot of people as well. And I've actually found that sometimes overpreparedness can actually add anxiety to the speaker, because they realize that they've gone off script and they just sort of, freeze when they're doing like dry runs and stuff like that. And so that's, you're describing the style that that I eventually adopted over the years as well, where every slide I could remember key points that I was trying to describe. But basically improv is definitely a way to put it, because it also felt like it was a more natural way of speaking to people. So I think those are excellent strategies.
So Josh, do you think that folks who have a technology background like us,
mm-hmm.
it feels to me like many of us carry maybe a greater fear of public speaking in a way. And
mm-hmm.
Maybe it's because we've kind of selected to be technologists. We're a little more back office in nature. It doesn't seem to bring out folks who are extroverts, the technology industry. So, what do you find in that regard? Do you find that, it takes a little extra to get, somebody who's a developer up on stage?
It definitely can. And it actually, when I was first talking to Dave Carroll about this job, which is just very much like that, right? Like it's part development, it's part coding, part technical enablement, and a lot of public speaking. And he's like, one of the hard things to do is find somebody who's really comfortable in all of those things. And I was lucky because not only was I a developer in a previous life, I was also a consultant. And as a consultant, I had to like sell people on technical ideas that may not be comfortable with them. But like members on my team, for instance, they didn't have to do that because I was the guy in the room doing that. And so I have had people who have submitted sessions in the past where they are very much, they have a technical thing that they're very much an expert on, but they're not really sure how to frame it and then how to sell it on stage. And some of the, I think you're right. I think our demographic probably leans to that a lot. And I think it's really good work to try to help them bridge that gap, you know, to get that technical information or that story that they have that may be unique to them and help them, you know, get that to stage. And it's one of the things I love about Dreamforce is I know that we have, you know, success stories of that every year. One of the years I did the developer track, we broke our record when it came to average survey scores. And when we did the end, you know, thank you to all our speakers, I just had to ask them, like, how many of you are first time speakers? Like, this was your first ever speakers. And about 30% of the people raised their hands. So to be able to get, you know, have a conference like that and have all these people for community have that like really special moment, it was really, really great. And I also have to admit myself, I'm a closet introvert, and that probably will surprise some people since most of them have probably seen me at workshops and public speaking and things like that. But to follow up with all of this, and I think you've touched on it a lot, it's like the other thing that's hard for me is like doing things after the session, like networking and talking to a lot of other people. But how has your experience been with that? Because it sounds like it's actually been very key to your success.
Well, I think like you, I'm inherently an introvert. And mm-hmm. the other thing I've learned is that most of the people who I admire who do a lot of presentations are actually introverts. Mm-hmm. And in exploring that more, I think there's a reason for it. You know, folks who are introverts and are on a stage, they're not on the stage for them. Right. They're there to give. Right. They don't want to be on stages. That's exhausting to them, right?
Right.
But that means they're going to be there for the right reasons, which yeah. I think biases them towards having better presentations because yeah. of you know, just that predisposition. And that's, you know, something that I see among, you know, a lot of the folks I admire. You know, Vala Afshar is someone I really admire on stage. And we often talk about how, you know, we're both introverts. We talk about imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. You know, Salesforce MVP, Amy Opplinger has a whole support group that you can join on imposter syndrome, right? And
nice.
she has a presentation on imposter syndrome, yeah. why we have that, why you should own it. You know, and my sort of whole theory on that is that we should always feel like imposters, because if we're really pushing ourselves, if we're really pushing towards our full potential, we're
right.
always going to feel uncomfortable and we're yeah. always going to be imposters. And it's actually a sign of learning, because you're an expert in something, but
yeah.
the perishability of knowledge in technology is really short.
Right.
So you need to be a beginner at a whole lot of things
yeah.
while you're an expert at something, so that the next version of you can be that next expert in the right thing.
Yeah.
And that means that you're an expert and an imposter at all times. And to the
right.
extent that you feel more like an imposter, that means you're really pushing your bounds.
Yeah.
And so that's why you should own it.
And that's our show. Now, before we go, I did ask Corey about his favorite non-technical hobby, and turns out there is something of a trend showing up here in the fact that people who work in the digital world want to get their hands on the physical.
My favorite non-technical hobby is building physical things. So,
okay.
you know, I mean, your day job is always building virtual things.
Yeah.
I really enjoy building physical things. So I was coaching, I coach youth robotics. So, you know,
nice.
I really enjoy, you know, building robots. I'm building a barn in my backyard. I like building physical things when I'm kind of like off the virtual clock. And I think in a COVID era, that's even more important because,
right.
you know, you're staring at a screen for 18 hours a day.
Yeah.
It's good to use your hands, right?
Thanks for listening, everybody, and my thanks to Corey for the excellent conversation. Now, if you want to learn more about this podcast, head on over to developer.salesforce.com/podcast, where you can hear old episodes, see the show notes, and have links to your favorite podcast service. I'll talk to you next week.